it's kind of a docudrama type thing.
Right, right. But they had this incident where he was being transferred and the prison guard, something happened and the prisoners could have walked free. I can't remember all the details.
Yeah.
And they didn't. And this one last night didn't mention that.
Yeah, there was a whole mix-up in getting Bonhoeffer from Berlin to Flossen, whatever it is. He got sent to one prison. Everybody else got sent to another. On the way, something happened where they stopped in a village. And really, they could have... Everybody grab yourselves a Bible, would you, before you come in? So, yeah, it was quite the mess. He wasn't executed in the same place that that his brother or the rest of the resistors were. He was executed in Flossenbürg. But they kind of alluded to it last night in the movie, but with him at the prison was a British prisoner of war. And the night before Bonhoeffer's execution, Bonhoeffer was Easter. He preached and he held a worship service for the other prisoners, including this British prisoner of war. And the next day, he was put to death.
Did he know that was going to happen?
He didn't know that it was going to happen the next day. He knew it was coming.
Yeah.
But bureaucracies work. Mm-hmm. They didn't kill the British prisoner of war. They sent him back. The Allied troops came in within 3 weeks and rescued that prison camp. And the British prisoner of war was still there and went back to England and told people in England that Bonhoeffer had been killed and about how he had died, just with this strong faith. And so that's why they had this memorial service in Great Britain. He had served for 2 years in London, so they knew of him. And that's how his parents found out.
They didn't mention that.
Yeah. It was on the BBC when they were talking about a memorial service for Bonhoeffer, because this British prisoner of war had told people in Great Britain and they held this memorial service. Now, his sister did live in Great Britain, but at that time there was no information going back and forth. I mean, Berlin and most of Germany was pretty much wiped out, so there wasn't a whole lot of communication anywhere. And they just happened to hear this.
Wasn't she married to a Jew? The sister?
Yes, she was married to a Jewish person.
So
yeah,
he was able to get out.
Yeah, because Bonhoeffer helps secret him and his sister away before it got too difficult. It was already getting difficult to emigrate out of Germany for Jews or anybody else that Hitler didn't want alive anymore. So Bonhoeffer was able to sneak them out through Switzerland. It was quite the process. But then she and her husband lived there in England for the duration of the war. So she was never in any danger other than the blitzkrieg of London. If you haven't already, please grab a Bible. Who has it? Does everybody have a Bible? The Bibles are out on a shelf out there.
But even with glasses, it's very dim. It's small.
One of the things we could do is
open
up. It is dark in this room.
It is dark.
You're gimping too. I can tell you're a little smart. Did you go to college?
I never did.
did. We camped at their last night. We went to Upper Lyman on the way back.
Oh, did you?
And you went to Waltham. Yeah. So we were with the Swans. I was glad you told me what your sermon was going to be about.
You experienced lots of swarms, flies, mosquitoes.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Especially mosquitoes up there, and then flies. Flies.
Yeah, there was lots of mosquitoes up there. Not so much at Holden, but on the way.
Yeah.
It was just, yeah. So, all right, let's get going. For those of you who don't know me yet, if you've come into the village or haven't attended a session yet, I'm Lori Junley. I am from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I teach at Augustana College in Sioux Falls. I'm a professor of religion and particularly ethics is my specialty. And I am excited to be here at Holden. This is my fourth time here. Grab yourselves a Bible before you come in, would you?
Yes.
We are spending some time this week talking about, I've become known as the Bonhoeffer lady in some ways. We're talking about Bonhoeffer, but we're also talking about, how do we turn these spotlights on? Is there a... Larger questions that we're then using Bonhoeffer to think about. The first day we discussed the question, what is community and what ought community be? Yesterday we talked about the question, who is in the community and who isn't, and who ought to be in the community and who ought not be. And then also the larger question of how does one get into the community. And we used Bonhoeffer's first part of the book, Discipleship or Cost of Discipleship, to talk about who is in the community and who isn't. Today we're going to be talking about a slightly different question, but all again related to the community. First, how do we live together? In community. How do we live together? This is the descriptive question. How do we actually do it? In fact, today we're going to spend less time on this question and more time on the prescriptive or ethical question, how ought we live together in community. Yesterday's discussion was mostly about how is the individual disciple called into the community. Today's discussion is going to be more about the community itself. How do we live together in community? Now, for those of you who attended the film last night, you may have heard this mentioned in the film. When Bonhoeffer was writing Discipleship, he's actually going against the grain in the Reformation Church, the Reformation churches, Calvinist Church, the Lutheran churches, because they all interpreted the Sermon on the Mount as something that wasn't doable by human beings because of sin. Therefore, what the Sermon on the Mount did for the Christian is accuse, shatter all of our attempts to save ourselves. I read the text that I should love my enemy. I know I absolutely can't do that. So I fall on my knees and I ask God for forgiveness. That's how it was usually interpreted. Bonhoeffer challenges that. He says, no, we can. Or actually, what he says is we must. Why must we not in order to save ourselves, not in order to prove our righteousness or earn God's grace or anything like that? We must because we're called. And we must obey. It's as simple as that for Bonhoeffer. We are called to live out the Sermon on the Mount, and therefore we must obey. So that was mentioned in the movie. One of the things that caught me in the film, I know some of you didn't see it, so I'll kind of explain a little bit. Early in Bonhoeffer's career, as the Nazis were rising to power, and as they started to put out their anti-Jewish stuff, or anti-Semite stuff, Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law's father died. Get that? Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law's father died. Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law was Jewish. Bonhoeffer was asked by the brother-in-law to do the funeral. And so he, being a younger pastor, not quite as willing to stand up for what was right at that particular time in his life, went to the church to ask their advice, the church leadership. And they advised him not to do the service because of the general anti-Semitic sentiment in the country. And so he said no. In the film, they have a quote from a letter that he wrote to his brother-in-law later on, expressing his dismay and his regret and his shame at not doing that service. And as I listened to this, I don't remember the exact wording, but as I listened to this letter, I thought immediately of what we're going to talk about today in the Sermon on the Mount about reconciliation. Here was a man who knew he had done something to hurt his neighbor, his brother-in-law. And instead of just, you know, saying, oh, well, he'll get over it, he writes a letter after the fact, I think it was several years after the fact, and apologizes and says he wishes he would have done differently, and if he had the opportunity to do it again, he would have done differently. And so... Bonhoeffer himself, as I read about his life, as I watch these films and read his biographies, I see hints at him trying to live out the Sermon on the Mount. Because you see, that's how Bonhoeffer answers this question for the Christian community, for individual Christians as well as the Christian community. How ought we live? We ought to live the Sermon on the Mount. The last verse of chapter 5 ends, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Yeah, right. And yet Bonhoeffer believes that through the power of Christ, it will become completely possible. But in this life, the Christian is called to live that life anyway. There will be failures. There will be mistakes. People will get hurt, but the Christian lives not worrying about those, instead acting on behalf of the neighbor and receiving Christ's forgiveness. So we're going to go through the Sermon on the Mount today. Actually, we're only going to go through chapter 5. Bonhoeffer, it's one of my favorite parts of his writings. He has an excellent, he basically just interprets the text of the Sermon on the Mount, verse by verse by verse, and it's absolutely beautiful. Now, there are some things that I might quibble with him about if he were sitting in the room, and I would say, now, Bonhoeffer, I'm not so sure I can go there with you, but for the most part, it's beautiful. And it really challenges me as I think about what he sees Jesus calling us to do and be in this Christian community. So we will be going through the text as we also go through Bonhoeffer's explanations. We won't cover everything that he does or says. This is just kind of meant to be a little glimpse into what he's saying. I'm going to sit because I hiked up to Holden Lake today and discovered the joy of going up and then coming down. If you've ever been on that hike, it's beautiful, but it's also up all the way and down all the way. So my legs are a little sore. I might get up and down a little bit. Where I'd like us to begin with this is in the scripture itself. So turn to Matthew chapter 5. And we're actually going to take a step back to yesterday, for those of you who attended yesterday, and deal a little bit again with the question of who. And you'll see in a minute what I mean. Chapter 5, verse 1. The Sermon on the Mount picks up at a place where Jesus is running around all over the place teaching and preaching and healing every disease and every sickness among all the people. And his fame is spreading all over the place. Everybody is hearing about him, and all these people who are healed and all their family members, everybody's following him. And so as you can see, the last verse of Matthew chapter 4 ends with, "And great crowds followed him from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and from beyond the Jordan." So he's got this whole herd or swarm of people following after him, all asking for him to heal them. We haven't yet had the feeding of the 5,000, but no doubt they think he can do just about anything, and they want to hear his message. So these great crowds of people are following. And then chapter 5, verse 1 begins, "When Jesus saw the crowds, he climbed up the mountain. And after he sat down, the disciples came to him. And then he began to speak and taught them," the disciples, "sinning." So who is Jesus speaking to in the Sermon on the Mount, according to that verse? The disciples. The crowds are still down on the mountain. He's up on the mountain. The disciples are gathered around. He's speaking to the disciples, not to the crowds. Now flip over to Matthew chapter 7, the very last verse, or the last two verses, verses 28 and 29. This reads, "Now when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as their scribes." So who heard the message?
Everybody
who was there. So we start out the Sermon on the Mount as Jesus is just teaching the disciples. It's just the disciples who are gathered around. By the end of the Sermon on the Mount, all the crowds have heard what he said. I hadn't realized this little detail until I read Bonhoeffer. And he points that out. And he makes something really interesting of that. He says that Jesus is speaking to the disciples as the core of what is to come. He's speaking to the disciples, but he's also, through the disciples, speaking to the crowd. And through the disciples, speaking to everyone. All are called. Jesus is speaking to the disciples, but they become the yeast, if you will. The leaven that will leaven the whole world, from Bonhoeffer's perspective. So it goes back to what we were talking about yesterday with the who. Who's in? Well, from Bonhoeffer's perspective, everybody is in, but they will come through the disciples. The disciples become the yeast, the leaven in the bread that will spread and cause everything to rise. And Bonhoeffer picks up on that, and it's really fascinating to see what he does with that. He also challenges the church, the people, so to speak, and says, okay, they've heard all this. Will they follow? Will they follow? Will they go after? Will they take up their cross and take up the Sermon on the Mount? And he just asks that question and lays it out there. Will they follow? Because obviously the church of his time is not. So I just wanted to point that out. Bonhoeffer's pretty clear that the disciples and the people include everybody who hears this message, including us today, are indeed one. We're all in the community. We're all called by God to be what we are, what we've been created by God to be. And he has this whole thing in Sanctorum Communio, what that means. It's very philosophical and very rich and very deep. But basically, to be truly human. The entire people and God are blessed, but we are blessed through this core community, which then, as Bonhoeffer will talk about and as Jesus talks about, becomes the light and the salt. All right? And so the question is, will they fall? All right. Let's continue on now. We are first going to look at one of the most familiar texts in all of Scripture, the Beatitudes. All right? What I'm going to do is ask somebody to read the first Beatitude, and I'm just going to share very briefly what Bonhoeffer's interpretation of that is. All right, and then we're only going to do this with the Beatitudes. We're not going to go through every verse of this. We'll be here until next week if we do that. But I think the Beatitudes are really powerful in this way. So who would like to read verse 3 of chapter 5?
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Bonhoeffer's interpretation of this is that the disciples, remember that's who he's speaking to, have renounced all their possessions, all their things, their family, all those earthly things. But not only have they renounced those, they've renounced their spiritual desires, their spiritual possessions, those things that they believe are theirs, spiritually. Any spiritual power of their own. Now, they haven't renounced this on their own. Remember, this comes after the call. The call has power. But they've done this. This renunciation has no power in itself, but it puts them in a position of faith. So they are poor. They are inexperienced. They are foolish, Bonhoeffer says, that they cannot hope for anything except for Jesus, who called. They've given up everything. They jumped off that cliff. That's how he starts in his interpretation of the Beatitudes. Okay, who wants to read verse 4?
Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted.
Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. How many of you, when you look around our country, maybe your community, our world, you feel sad. You feel worried. Maybe some anger, frustration, but you feel sad. I know I do. I watch the news, I read the newspaper. That whole business in Colorado that I was watching and listening to as I came to Holden Village, you know, I was angry, I was frustrated, but I was mostly just sad. That's how Bonhoeffer interprets this verse. He says, the disciples who have renounced everything also renounce happiness. Not necessarily joy, but happiness. this sense that everything is going great with the world and everything will pull itself together, because they know better. They know better. They see the problems and they know they can't fix them, that it has to come from God. And so they mourn. They mourn what is going on with the world. That's how he interprets that text. Verse 5.
Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth.
What do you think about when you think about the meek? What does meekness mean to you?
Well, I think it means something different than it used to mean.
Say more.
I think it used to mean the meek were the people who didn't know something, and now we think of it as people who are more like passive.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was saying the meek were those who were willing to learn, and so the meek are those who are willing to learn, and so that those people will inherit the earth, not necessarily people who are passive.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly one interpretation. It's not where Bonhoeffer goes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Bonhoeffer goes with the meek are everybody who renounce all their rights. Think about that for a second. Think of all the rights we in our country and around the world claim that we are entitled to. He says the meek, the disciples, the ones who are called, are those who renounce their rights. They no longer claim their right to X, Y, or Z.
And be at every level, family level,
yep.
Job level, professional level,
mm-hmm. Et cetera. Yeah, because remember, the first beatitude is about you've already given up all those things. Yeah. Bonhoeffer says this in this beautiful passage, he says, every beatitude further separates this Christian community, this community of disciples, from the rest of the world. The rest of the world says, we demand our rights. And when my rights are taken away, I have the right to stand up and demand my rights, right? But Bonhoeffer says, the meek are those who renounce those rights, who don't claim the right to speak freely, or the right to bear arms, or the right to fill in the puzzle. See how much more radical this is getting? We don't want to hear that, particularly here in America. We like our rights, and we'll fight for them. And we're supposed to actually fight for somebody else's rights. Now, Bonhoeffer does agree with that. He does agree that we should fight for others' rights, not fight, not beat people up, because as we'll get here in a second, he's very pacifist. But he does say we should stand up for others' rights, not for our own. Serving the neighbor is about standing up for their rights when somebody else is taking them away. But the meek, they don't stand up for their own. They suffer.
In a way, aren't you then requiring a community to stand up for your rights then?
Yep.
So your rights are protected by the rest of the community, not by you fighting for them.
That's the way it's supposed to be. Yeah. And he's not alone in saying this either, although Luther doesn't use the language of rights. Luther says the same thing. The one who suffers should do so as bearing that suffering. But it's up to the neighbor of the sufferer to stand up and say no. That's what it means to bear the sin of the neighbor. But the sufferer doesn't do that. Jesus didn't. And remember, this is all about following Jesus. Okay, the next one. Somebody want to read that?
Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled.
Hunger and thirst for righteousness. Bonhoeffer takes a slightly different tactic here. We all like to think that, particularly in our day and age, that we're okay people. You know, nobody's perfect. But I make
make mistakes, but I'm a pretty good person. I'm better than you. Right? I make mistakes, I hurt people, but, you know, I'm a pretty good person. Bonhoeffer says the next thing that the disciples, or the called, renounce is their own righteousness, their sense of self-righteousness. Now suddenly I don't have my own righteousness. Now I am the worst of all sinners. He says that earlier in the text. The Christian must think of themselves as the worst of all sinners. Nobody is more sinful than me. Nobody. And when one has that attitude, a person can't go around judging anybody else. You have to give up your own self-righteousness. It's getting more and more radical. Next. I'll read this one. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Okay, now we're really hitting the end of the stick. Mercy is what? What do we do when we do mercy? What does God do when God does mercy?
Forgive.
Forgive.
Compassion.
Show compassion.
Not give us our justice.
Huh?
Not give us our just deserts.
Not give us what we deserve, except.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Bonhoeffer pushes this to the extreme and says, the center of mercy is when we give up our honor and our dignity. When we are willing, when the Christian is willing to get down in the muck and the mire and the garbology of somebody else's suffering. That's what mercy is. Mercy is being willing to give up everything that gives me honor and dignity and become undignified and unhonorable for the sake of them. He says this is the last possession. And if a disciple can't give up this possession, it will haunt them. They won't be able to follow as Christ calls them. Mercy is about giving up the very center of who we are, or at least who we think we are. It's getting harder. Verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Now, here I have a quote on your sheet. It's the second quote under the word blessed. This is his explanation. Who is pure in heart? Only those who have completely given their hearts to Jesus, so that he alone rules in them. Okay. Only those who do not stain their hearts with their own evil, but also not with their own good. Uh-oh. A pure heart is the simple heart of a child who does not know about good and evil. It's the heart of Adam before the fall. The heart in which the will of Jesus rules instead of one's own conscience. Those who renounce their own good and evil, their own heart, who are contrite and depend solely on Jesus, have purity of heart to the word of Jesus. What does this mean? Renounce their own good and evil. He's, of course, referring back to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil from which Adam and Eve ate, and thus was their first sin. He thinks it's more than just disobeying God. Something happened when they ate that fruit. They knew something they didn't know before, and they shouldn't have known, according to Bonhoeffer. Good and evil. Basically, what this means is I'm out of a job as an ethicist. Which is so hilarious to me because the next thing he writes, in fact, as it was mentioned in the film, the major thing he wants to
be his ultimate statement is a book on ethics. But this is saying that our attempts to define good and evil and to judge people accordingly, the disciple needs to renounce that. Jesus actually repeats this idea later on in the sermon when he says, don't judge. Because if you judge, you're going to have to worry about the log in your own eye. But Bonhoeffer believes, and how he works this out in interesting ways in ethics, and also in his study on Genesis, but he believes that one, in their behavior and deciding what they should do, is to simply follow Jesus, simply obey. Well, he actually does a little more than that. He says, in fact, we need to listen to the neighbor and listen to what the neighbor needs and then serve our neighbor. Because that's what Jesus commands, right? That's what Jesus does, is we obey the neighbor. We serve the neighbor. It's getting harder and harder. Yeah.
I don't want to get you off track, but I think it's fascinating that he articulates that in light of his own resistance of Nazism.
Yeah.
And how ironic that he would articulate, because he struggled so much with whether it was justified or right to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways, doesn't use that argument at all, but rejects the distinction between good and evil to say, well, is it a sin boldly?
I think and he wrote this while he was at Finkenwald and finished it. He hadn't made that, he kind of knew what was happening through his family. You think this is ironic, wait till the next Beatitude when it talks about the peacemakers. Because he very clearly says in discipleship, you should not murder. And what does he do? He participates in an assassination plot.
If you're giving up your own sense of good and evil for yourself, then isn't it, you don't judge what you're doing at all?
Exactly.
So murder is one of the things you do.
Yes.
I didn't nail that one, but
yes. Yes and no. One of the things that when reading Bonhoeffer, we have to, I think he struggles with this in his own mind, because he really tried to figure out, is this, should I do this, should I not, should I participate in the resistance, should I not, and he really was working this through with his own conscience. But at the same time, in reading his theology, the thing to remember is that for Bonhoeffer, all of us is gone. Every part of who we think we are. So that includes this judgment of whether I'm doing right or wrong. But I don't just leave it at that. That means I can go and do everything. That's exactly what he's saying no to in this. What do? I follow Christ. Where does Christ lead me? To the cross, in serving my neighbor. So whatever I do, I don't even need to think about it according to Bonhoeffer. I just need to serve my neighbor. What is the service to the neighbor? So it's not going to be, well, I can decide to murder somebody this week, and it's okay. No, it's always, there's always that follow Christ, and follow Christ in service of the neighbor. But you're right in saying that we shouldn't be thinking about whether it's right or wrong. He never came to the conclusion that what he did was right. He never came to the conclusion that what he did was wrong. Finally, he says, I can do only what I think is in service of the neighbor and suffer the consequences accordingly. And by consequences, he doesn't just mean the consequences given to him by the Nazis. He means the consequences that it may indeed come from God. But he knows, he believes that what he has to do is serve the neighbor. And this is, for him,
at that time, the only way to serve the neighbor is to get rid of Hitler. Not to go on a mass murder spree, but to kill one man in order to help the whole nation, in fact, the whole world. I want to go on to the Blessed Are the Peacemakers very briefly because, yes, guess what? Jesus, Bonhoeffer calls the disciples to make peace. In other words, renounce all violence and strife. Maintain peace by choosing to suffer instead of causing others to suffer. And yet, a few years later, he chooses to participate in the resistance. It's clear that discipleship, while not an early work, is a work where he hasn't really thought through what it means to actually live out what needs to happen in his own life. He's still trying to figure that out. And that happens a little later. But he does, and he never loses this. Basically what he says, and I'll talk about that tomorrow when we actually talk about ethics, his work in ethics, is he says that this isn't his words, but mine. Basically, 99.9% of the time, we follow the commandments. Because that's what loves the neighbor, right? When we choose not to covet, that's loving our neighbor. When we choose not to kill somebody, that's loving our neighbor. When we choose not to judge, we're loving our neighbor. 99.9% of the time, we follow Jesus, and he leads us right into the commandments that God has given us. But there are very rare and extraordinary circumstances in which the call of Christ surpasses even the law, even the commandment not to kill. And that circumstance is the necessity of the neighbor. When there is nothing else left to do for the needs of the neighbor but to take a life, one throws oneself on the mercy of God and does so. But it's a last resort for the sake of the neighbor. And he struggled with that. But what's so fascinating is once he made the decision to participate, the struggle, while still there, kind of wasn't as strong. Now he became, as the film said last night, kind of the moral guide for the resistance leaders, helping them think through their own moral scruples about this. And when he went to prison, he just accepted that that was the consequences of his action. And he bore it with amazing fortitude and peace and acceptance. You can see this in his letters. Certainly he was a human being and he struggled, but that's what a lot of the prisoners and the guards and others noticed about him and why they came to him for comfort and consolation. Even the guards. That's how he was able to get books in and out, because these guards saw in him something and they were willing to do these things for him, even though they had no clue what was happening in those books with the little coded messages. So, he's still a human being. There's one second section in the letters and papers of prison where he talks about one guy who just will not leave him alone. Just will not leave him alone. Keeps coming and coming and coming. And he writes in there, "Finally, I just have to try to avoid it," he says. You know, you can just see his humanity coming out, and he just can't deal with this guy anymore. But, and so it's kind of a delight to read that, because otherwise he almost seems too good to be true, and even in the letters themselves. But you can see the struggle, and yet at the same time, in the midst of the struggle, he lives it out. Or at least as much as anyone can do. I want to go forward a little bit into the next section, the section on kindred.
Well, actually, I want to talk a little bit about salt and light. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything, but it is thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under a bushel basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works, not you, but your good works, and give glory to your Father in heaven. One of the things that was happening at the time was the church was hiding itself. And Bonhoeffer is calling the community of disciples to stand up and be visible. Not with themselves, hey, look at me, I'm so awesome, I'm an amazing Christian. No. Look at the good works. What are the good works? I'm standing up for the Jews. I'm standing up against Nazism. I'm standing up for the poor, the helpless, the needy. Not because I'm particularly special, but because Christ has called me, and I obey. The quote on the sheet here, this third one down, it says, "You are the salt, not you should be the salt." Here, it's Bonhoeffer interprets this as a gospel, not a law, a piece of good news. You are the salt. The disciples are given no choice whether they are salt or not. No appeal is made to them to become the salt of the earth. Rather, they just are salt, whether they want to be or not, by the power of the call which has reached them. You are the salt, not you have the salt. It says the same thing about the light. It's just supposed to gleam out of the disciples as they do and fulfill all these beatitudes. And guess what? When and if they do that, they're going to get killed. Just like Christ was. For Bonhoeffer, part of the problem in that time was that the church was hiding itself, or hiding the gospel message. Hiding the light that was supposed to be shining. Hiding the, burying the salt or getting rid of the salt, saltiness. And following blindly Hitler. Those of you who saw the film last night, did you notice the couple of images that had the sun shining with the swastika in it? Those images were quite prevalent. Before even Hitler got on the scene, Germany was already looking for a savior, and that's the language they used. They wanted a savior. And they, you know, after World War I and the humiliation and the economic struggles, and they weren't taking to democracy the way the West wanted them to, and things were messy, and the German people wanted a savior. And then Hitler came along, and he owned that. Later, he became their savior, and they ate it up. And the church, a large portion of it anyway, went right along with it. And when they did so, their saltiness was gone, and their light was buried underneath a bushel basket. And Bonhoeffer says, no. The community needs to be visible. Not by standing on street corners and proclaiming, not by big billboards and signs and flashing things and those types of things, but simply through how it serves the neighbor, how it loves the neighbor. That's how the community becomes visible. All right, I'm going to jump on to the kindred part. This is verses 21 through 26. This is the section on murder. We're right back to irony here. Jesus says, "You have heard it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you," this is the series of "but I say to yous," "that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say, 'You fool,' you will be liable to the hell of fire. So when you are offering your gift on the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother or sister, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are on the way to court with him, or your accuser may hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and so forth. Truly, I tell you, you will never get out until you pay the last penny. Bonhoeffer, you can see here the interpretation of this in this quote. Individuals as well as church communities, notice it's not just the individual, it's the community, who intend to enter God's presence with contemptuous or unreconciled hearts are playing games with an idol. As long as we withhold service and love from a brother or sister, as long as he or she remains a target of our contempt, as long as a sister or brother has something against me or Jesus' community, in other words, we have done something to them, our offerings will remain unaccepted. It's not just my own anger which gets between me and God, but even the fact that a brother or sister exists whom I have abused, humiliated, and dishonored, and who has something against me. So the community of Jesus' disciples ought to examine itself as to whether it is here and there at fault towards sisters or brothers, and whether for the sake of the world it has participated in hating, despising, and humiliating others. To do these things is to be guilty of their murder. Bonhoeffer here is speaking, I think, certainly in general, but he's also speaking directly to this church. As long as the church is participating in hating the Jews, despising them, and humiliating them, whether or not they were at the concentration camp delivering gas, they are guilty of murder. The church is guilty of murder. Now, this is a strong statement, and one that congregations in our society and churches in our society need to think about. Who are we as Christians hating, despising, and humiliating? For Bonhoeffer and for Jesus, at least as Bonhoeffer interprets him, we are guilty of murder. It gets more and more hard to be this disciple, to participate in this community. Let's go on just a little further. He goes. Jesus, of course, in the Sermon on the Mount, continues with this, you have heard it said, but I say to you. The next section is the section on lust. If you lust after, in this case, he's speaking to male disciples, of course. if you... You have heard it said that you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who even looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go to hell. That's asking the impossible. Yeah, I can control my actions, but I can't control what my body does. But Bonhoeffer says, yes, we can. And then it's in this section where he responds to the question that I just asked. And this is on the quote on the back, on the first quote on the back side. Did Jesus really mean it? Did he really mean I'm supposed to cut out my eye or chop off my hand? Did he really mean I'm not supposed to feel these feelings that happen outside of my control? Whether those feelings are lust or judging others or being angry with others? And Bonhoeffer says, I'll just read the quote here. We might, whether this commandment is to be taken literally or merely figuratively, but the question itself is wrong and evil. In other words, we shouldn't even ask the question. The question can't be answered, does Jesus really mean it? If we were to say that, of course, the command is not meant to be taken literally, then we would have dodged the seriousness of the command, right? Jesus is pretty darn serious about this, otherwise he wouldn't say it. And so if we say, of course, he's not talking literally, he just means spiritually cut off your eye, then we dodge the seriousness of the command. But, on the other hand, if we were to say, of course, it should be taken literally, this would only show that Christian experience is absurd on principle, and the command would lose its authority. I mean, cut out your eye? How is that going to prevent lust? That's ridiculous. So Bonhoeffer says even asking the question is the wrong question. It's precisely the fact that for us this basic question is not answered that binds us completely to Jesus' command. Neither option offers us an escape. We are trapped and we must obey. This is what Bonhoeffer continues to do and say in his ethics. Stop asking the question why. Any of you have three-year-olds or had them? Why do I have to do that? Why do I have to go to bed? Why do I have to eat my broccoli? Why? We're very good at why. Again, this comes back to me losing my job. That's what ethicists do. We talk about why do you care for others? Why do you not kill people? Bonhoeffer says, don't worry about the question why, simply do it. Simply do it. Just do it, like the Nike commercial said. Don't worry about why. So he doesn't answer the question. He basically says the question is not helpful. In fact, he says it's wrong and evil. The next section, of course, is the section about, at least that I talk about, or I have a quote from, is that the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. This starts on 2038. Oh, I can't see. You have heard it said that an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, Jesus says, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. Anybody done that? Somebody sued you and you just gave away everything? Yeah, yeah, doesn't happen very often. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go the second mile. Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow. He goes into this long diatribe about how that's exactly what political entities do. They live according to an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. What did we do after 9/11? Well, we hunted down Osama bin Laden, and we finally killed him. We also went to war in Iraq, and Afghanistan, which some would argue maybe that was not the actual eye for an eye. It could have been or should have been. Bonhoeffer says with this statement, as you can see from the quote, Jesus releases his community from the political and legal order. No longer is his community bound to the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth mentality. He makes this community into what it truly is, namely the community of the faithful that is not bound by a political or national tie. For the community of disciples which makes no national or legal claims for itself, retribution means patiently bearing the blow so that evil is not added to evil. That's the only way community can be established and preserved. And then he goes on to say, the more terrible the evil, the more willing the disciple should be to suffer. Basically, it's the idea of breaking the cycle. If I hit you, and you hit me back, and then I might kill you. And then your relative kills me, but then my relative kills another one of your relatives, and pretty soon we have the Hatfields and McCoys. I don't know if you saw that History Channel miniseries. It was awesome. But that's the way it works. That's an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth.
restorative justice like what they practice in South Africa.
Yeah, reconciliation.
Yes.
Yeah. And you know, Jesus and Bonhoeffer make it seem really easy, and we all know it isn't easy. We know it hasn't been easy for the people in South Africa, and yet they struggle through it and they move through it. The same things are being tried in Rwanda, for example, and that's very difficult for some of those people. How do you tell a person whose family was massacred in front of you to forgive the people who massacred your family? It's very difficult. And yet, the way of the disciple is to take on that suffering. I don't think what Bonhoeffer means is I'm supposed to go tell you that you should forgive your neighbor and make it a law. It's more about me. If you hit me, I need to just take it. If you do something bad to me, I, as a disciple, need to just bear it instead of retaliating.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The good point about that is change occurs from the heart rather than out of fear.
Yeah, yeah.
When we're accepted without retribution.
Right.
Or judgment.
Yeah. And that's a great psychological analysis of what's going on here. Bonhoeffer had some concerns about psychology and psychiatry, even though maybe it was because his dad was one. He didn't say that it should be thrown out, but he did believe that psychiatry and spirituality should be completely separated. I don't know if I can go there with him. I think we can learn a lot from the social sciences, including psychology, about how and why humans behave the way they do, but nonetheless, he does make some good points about that. But that's very key.
But there's one other point, and that is that if we experience that, then we really get it.
Right.
We're accepted, you know, mm-hmm. but not necessarily psychological. That's what we experience personally.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I want to quickly jump to the very last quote, because that's what this whole thing is supposed to be about. This whole idea of being perfect. Jesus ends this section, as I said, with this idea of be perfect, therefore, as your Father in heaven is perfect. The disciples are called to do more than what regular people do. They're called to be more, to be extraordinary, to be perfect. And so this quote here, I'd like to end the session with, is what Bonhoeffer, how he interprets this. He says, what does the extraordinary consist of? It is the existence of those blessed in the Beatitudes, the life of the disciples. It is the shining light, the city on the hill. It is the way of self-denial, perfect love, perfect purity, perfect truthfulness, perfect nonviolence. Here is undivided love for one's enemies, loving those who love no one and whom no one loves. It is for one's religious, political, or personal enemy. The perfect are none other than those who in the Beatitudes are called blessed. In other words, those who love with godly love. The best example I can think of is the Amish. After the mass murder took place in their school and how they have responded to that. It's just, there's no other explanation than divine love there. You know, I think about what I might do if that were me or my family. And I don't know if I can be like that. But that's what Bonhoeffer means. He means that, and remember, it's not through our own righteousness. It's not through the power of me that makes this possible. It's through the power of the call that comes through Christ. And I'm called simply to live. And not worry if I'm doing a great job at it, not worry if I've heard the call right, just do it. If there's any motto that Bonhoeffer's ethics would have, that would be it. Just do it. Just obey. Just follow Christ. And don't think about it. Good luck with that. Thank you very much.